A researcher discovers hidden figures behind the push to desegregate America's schools, girls and young women.
We just walked into this crowd so confident that we were doing the right thing that I just don't think we ever for a moment thought about being afraid.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We meet one of UGA's first black students and look at the critical role the media played in the movement.
President Kennedy appealed to the students and to the people of the state to comply peacefully with the law and bring the crisis to an end.
And Mike Mills of REM adds to our Georgia playlist.
The song is kind of spare. There's not that much going on, but there's just enough going on. If you saw Pylon play and you heard this song and you didn't dance, it's because you were sick.
Coming up after the news. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, made segregation of America's public schools illegal. In the decades leading up to the landmark decision, lawsuits brought by girls and young women chipped away at the foundations of segregation. Historian Rachel Devlin spent a decade uncovering and interviewing the women whose trailblazing road has long been neglected. Her new book is called A Girl Stands at the Door, The Generation of Young Women Who Desegregated America's Schools. And Rachel joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Your book begins in 1947. The scene is Marguerite Daisy Carr and her father approaching the steps of a white middle school in Washington, D.C. Bring us back and describe that scene.
So when Marguerite Carr and her father decided that she was going to try to simply enroll at Elliott Junior High, the junior high closest to her home, they simply went to the white school and walked up the steps to meet the principal. But the principal got wind of it, that they were coming, and the black community knew as well. And it was so radical at the time for a black child to enter a white school that the students in the school pressed up against the window to see what would happen. And the teachers, the students, the janitors, the principal of her black junior high school lined the sidewalk on the other side. So everybody was watching as she walked up the steps. The principal came out and he said, "You don't want to come here." And she said, very politely but firmly, "Yes, I do want to come to this school." Once she was rejected and turned away, she and her father went and filed a school desegregation lawsuit. But Marguerite Carr's poise and steadfast ability to speak to the white principal was very important in that moment.
Right. And this story fits into a pattern involving girls and young women that you discovered. This is in the years leading up to Brown versus Board of Education. What did you find?
I found that Brown v. Board really was a grassroots movement led by young women and girls, often in concert with their parents. These girls in rural Texas, Louisiana, Virginia, Washington, D.C., Kansas, a range of places between 1947 and 1949 simply tried to walk into white schools to register. And just like Marguerite Carr, when turned away, and they usually, by the way, never made it past the front steps. Principals would not even let them in the door of the school. And once they were turned away, they filed their lawsuits. They did this first, and then they contacted the national office of the NAACP later. So it really was a grassroots movement of young people, young women, and their parents who are really desperate to have options, better options for schools, attempting to desegregate.
This is
on their own.
Girls in elementary school, high school, and college, 1940s and 1950s, as you said. So why girls, and why then?
You know, to desegregate a school, you need, first and foremost, a commitment to the ideal of school desegregation. You need to be able to imagine yourself in that white school, to look at the edifice of a white school and say to yourself, your parents, a lawyer, I can go there and talk to that white principal. I can go there and hold my own with those students. Girls disproportionately believe this. They also had the social imagination to see something that had never happened before. It's important to remember in the late 1940s that black and white children had never gone to school before. No one knew what that might look like. So social optimism was required. The second thing that is informed these young women's approach to these schools is that they had the skills to do it. They were quite frankly good at it. You had to have physical courage, but also social dexterity in order to talk to school administrators, lawyers, and the press. They were poised, self-possessed, personable, diplomatic, and patient.
Yeah. In fact, Marguerite Carr Stokes, now Stokes, said to that principal, "I knew how to act in polite company." She had that skill. Now, Rachel, how did you discover these young women's stories?
So it's funny, you know, for a previous project, my first book, I was looking through Ebony Magazine from 1945 to 1965. And as I was going through it, I found that whenever there was an article about desegregation, whether a student was desegregating a graduate school, visiting Sarah Lawrence, or a high school, often in the Midwest, which started desegregating earlier, all of these stories were about girls. And I was quite struck by that. And I thought, oh, is this just editorial bias, or is this actually the case? So I went to the National Archives and Library of Congress and looked through the files of the NAACP, and there I found all of these cases between 1947 and 1949 that were filed on behalf of girls.
Now, we think of, when we think of school desegregation, one of the popular American images is that Norman Rockwell painting, The Problem We All Live With, a little girl in a white dress. Many think Ruby Bridges, although he says it's a kind of amalgamation. These girls stepping forward, there's this sort of projection of innocence. Were girls considered less threatening than boys?
That's what's so interesting, is that they were not. When girls, from our current perspective, and we see the white bow on her hair and her small stature, we tend to see a vulnerable girl. In 1960, when those four girls tried to desegregate or did desegregate the schools in New Orleans, they were not seen as innocent. They were simply seen as black. And Southerners were terrified of black children as black people. They believed that, as one mother put it, they would ruin their children scholastically, morally, spiritually, and in every other way. Girls, black girls, were not afforded that sense of innocence that white girls were in 1960, especially in the South.
Well, in fact, they were painted often as corrupting influences, you know, sexually promiscuous. Is that one of the tactics that was employed against them?
Yes, you see in court cases that lawyers would use material that painted black girls as hypersexual and promiscuous. In a school desegregation case in Baton Rouge, the lawyer used a poster that showed illegitimate births by age, girls 10 to 14, trying to show that black girls had more babies out of wedlock. During the Supreme Court deliberations, Justice Tom Clark of Texas said the real problem with school desegregation is that black girls tend to get pregnant. The perspective on black girls' sexuality was quite damning and tended to contribute to a sense that black girls would be sexually dangerous to white boys.
One of the common experiences, of course, these girls didn't do it themselves. They had families behind them, sometimes their fathers or mothers fired from their jobs. Some, Gail Vavasur Jones, she desegregated Baton Rouge High School, did not have support of her parents and did not always have support of the NAACP, which really hadn't considered school desegregation as the best path forward. What were some of the arguments for and against among the NAACP?
Well, the NAACP, by the time Gail Jones desegregated Baton Rouge High in 1963, the NAACP was fully behind grade school desegregation. It was in the late 1940s when the NAACP actually preferred to go a little slower. What happened was they won an important graduate school case that they had been fighting since 46. But between 46 and 49, they had no plans to fight for school desegregation on the grade school level. What happened was that when all of these parents and their daughters, and some high school girls, too, and young women on the graduate level, kept coming and kept suing and kept attempting to enroll in these white schools, it became clear to the NAACP that they would have to take on a grade school desegregation case because these parents and these girls were not going to let go. They were hanging on to these lawsuits. They were getting a lot of coverage in the black press. The black press was thrilled with these lawsuits. And they just kept rolling in. And so finally, the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall in New York said, we have to argue this.
Well, we are going to talk about the role of the black press a little later in the show. But now let's bring in one of the women who was on the front lines. Charlene Hunter-Galt is with us by Skype from Florida. She and her classmate Hamilton Holmes were the first African-American students to attend the University of Georgia. And they desegregated the state's flagship university. This was in 1961. Charlene went on to become a journalist for PBS, CNN, and NPR. Charlene Hunter-Galt, the thrill to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I'm learning so much from both of you. Thank you for having me.
You were finally admitted to the University of Georgia in 1961. What did you encounter when you arrived on campus then? It was January 9th.
Well, it was a raucous crowd of white students who were shouting ugly epithets and things at us. And I was with my mother, who's a lot shorter, was a lot shorter than I am. And when I was walking from registration over to the journalism school, I was walking with Vernon Jordan, who was a young lawyer at the time and escorted us in. And my mom yelled out, "Listen, my legs are not as long as yours. Slow down." But, you know, it wasn't out of fear. It was out of wanting to keep up so she could be with her daughter.
Well, here's just a sense of the scene. Student protesters surrounding your arrival at the University of Georgia. The familiar refrain, 2468, we don't want to integrate. Let's listen to a University of Georgia student, this is 1961, explaining why he doesn't want African American students at UGA.
I'm not for integration, I'm for segregation, and I will be until I die. Yeah!
Charlene, did police and university officials protect you?
Yes, they did. You know, there was a Dean Tate. I never knew what his political ideology was, but I remember Hamilton and I were sitting in the car once, and these white boys surrounded the car. And he was a sort of hefty old guy, and he jumped out of the car and told them to disperse in no uncertain terms. So I never really felt threatened. The words just sort of went over my head, and I often tell the story that back in the days of segregation, we had a village, and that village of black people protected us. And I said, when they couldn't give us first-class citizenship, they gave us a first-class sense of ourselves. And although our school got hand-me-down books, it was pages torn out from the white schools, the black parents and neighborhood people would raise money every year and have this contest that whichever family had the most money, the son or daughter would be crowned king or queen. And one year I got to be crowned queen. And I said, you know, that I wore that crown. They gave us gave me a diamond, quote unquote, diamond tiara. And I said, I wore that crown several days, and I was just insufferable to my classmates. And finally, they persuaded me to take off the crown. And I said, but the notion that I was a queen took up residence in my head. And so years later...
Charlotte, Jillian, let me ask you to hold on because we want to continue speaking with you and Rachel Devlin, but we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Charlene Hunter-Gault, who was one of the first students to attend, Black students to attend University of Georgia, and Rachel Devlin, who wrote about the role that girls and women played in desegregation. We're talking this hour about some of the unsung heroes of the movement to desegregate America's public school, among them reporters for regional Black newspapers, and girls and young women. We've been speaking with Charlene Hunter-Gault. She was one of the first two African-American students to attend the University of Georgia. At UGA, she majored in journalism, and with her fellow student activists Julian Bond and Lonnie King, helped to launch the Atlanta Enquirer. It's an African-American newspaper in 1960. Hank Klibanoff is with us. He is former managing editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and in 2007, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Race Beat, about how the civil rights movement was covered in the national media. Hello, Hank.
Good morning.
Well, we want to continue with Rachel Devlin and learn a little bit more about the experience of girls and young women in African-American, the movement for desegregation. Now, Rachel, Charlene was just talking a little bit about her community and how they supported her. Was that typical for the experience of the girls and young women that you spoke to?
Not entirely. In particular, in the late 1940s, it was such a radical idea to try to desegregate a school that these Black girls experienced backlash. Certainly from the white community in which they lived, but often from the Black community as well. Some people felt that, you know, these girls were causing trouble and they were making life harder for them. And there was both, there was ostracism and sometimes violent backlash. Once Brown had been formed, been passed, and Black young women and girls disproportionately volunteered to desegregate the schools in the early 1960s, places like Baton Rouge, Albany, Georgia. They were supported by their communities, but often these high school girls, their mothers were very frightened about what was going to happen to them. And many of them desegregated despite the fears of their mothers and parents. Others told me that there were members of the community that thought they were crazy. They thought that it would never work. And then finally, some who went to some of the better Black schools had teachers and principals asking them not to transfer because of the loss that it would entail for their institution. So it was complicated.
Charlene, you have written and spoken about the experience of being very light-skinned and, in quote-unquote, passing for white in some cases. How did that change, or how did that contribute to your experience as a forerunner and an integrator?
Well, I don't think that, I mean, I'm not sure where you got the passing for white, other than the fact that sometimes the Black kids in elementary school would taunt me and say, come on, white girl, and try to make me get into fights. But that was just part of the ritual of being, of growing up in the South in those years. And I just want to say to, Rachel, that what you've just described was, of course, earlier than when Hamilton and I went into UGA, but that was the same reaction of a lot of Black people to the whole Atlanta student movement, which had, you know, many women in the forefront going to jail and having some awful experiences. And I think part of it was a fear of you know, what might happen not only to the young people who were pioneering desegregation, but to Black families. And even the Black newspaper didn't support the Black students because they had white advertisers.
Well, yes, that's fair. Yes.
Well, Hank, that's something that you must know a lot about. You know, you studied the mechanics of how newspapers work, and you've worked in newsrooms in Philadelphia, here in Atlanta, at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Is that something typical that you would see, that there would be debates within how to cover this, even within the Black newspapers and communities?
And there would have been. In the Black newspapers at the time, there was no question in the minds of most editors about what was right and what was wrong. In Atlanta, quite interestingly, and most dominant black newspaper, the Atlanta Daily World, there was a debate because they cited generally for a slower movement. And they opposed including Dr. King in his own hometown. And they thought he was moving too fast. And they were certainly pro-civil rights, but they left an opening that Charlene's talking about for the Atlanta Inquirer to be born from their complacency on the issue.
And Charlene, you eventually were one of those founding reporters for that newspaper. What weren't you seeing in the press? What weren't you seeing in coverage that led you to that?
Well, they simply were not covering the activities of the Atlanta student movement. And I used to leave UGA on the weekends and drive 73 miles or so to Atlanta to work for the paper because, A, I wanted to get the experience, and the red and black newspaper of the University of Georgia, the editor, Tom Johnson, who went on to become head of CNN and welcomed me, but I never got any assignments because a lot of the things that went on in Athens were in the still segregated town. So I wasn't getting any experience, but on the weekends, and I didn't want to, you know, make a big deal out of it or get into trouble at UGA by picketing and stuff. So I would stay in Carl Holman's basement. The students would demonstrate in the morning, get arrested in the afternoon, get bailed out later, and then come to the basement and tell me their stories. And eventually I was able to get out into the larger community and do bigger stories. So that was my whole my first real experience at doing journalism, doing reporting. We called it, we didn't call ourselves journalists in those days. Everybody's a journalist today. But in those days, if you're a reporter, that's what you were. Walter Cronkite was a journalist, you know, but not us. And it was amazing because we broke a lot of news. And I think, I'd like to think we made a difference.
Well, the voice from on high was then Walter Cronkite on the news and considerably swayed the ways that things could go. But, you know, I didn't ask you, you and Hamilton, when you applied to UGA, what was your motivation for that? That was a very bold move at that time.
Well, for me, there was no journalism school in the South at a black school, and I wanted to study journalism. I had been editor of the school paper, the Turner High School Green Light, and as a junior, the first junior editor, and as a senior, and I was serious about this. I wanted to be a journalist since I read about Brenda Starr in the newspapers when I was 5 or 6 years old, and so it was. Was a path that I wanted to take, and several leaders of the black community who came to our school, which was one of the top schools in the city at the time, Turner High School, and wanted to know if there were any students who might be interested, because it's interesting what Rachel said a few minutes ago, because they had initially taken a young woman who was willing to do it down to Georgia State and to try and desegregate the college in town, and she was turned down because she had had a child out of wedlock. Mm-hmm. Now, in those days, that was dispositive. So they wanted some, as they said, clean-cut young people, and Hamp was the first in his class of 156 or so. I was third, and we just jumped on it right away. But what's interesting, you know, as I said a long time ago, when they couldn't give us first-class citizenship, they gave us a first-class sense of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So when we went down to Georgia State, Hamilton and I looked at that syllabus down there, and we said, no, this isn't good enough for us. And Hamilton was the one who said, no, I want to go. And he pointed north to UGA, and I wasn't going to let him get ahead of me. We were always loved each other, but we were competitive. And so I said, yeah, me too. And that's how it happened. And it was dangerous because one of the reasons they wanted us to go to Georgia State as a test case was because they could protect us in Atlanta, the men, the black men, but they didn't have anybody in Athens, and you had to go through Ku Klux Klan territory even to get there. But we were so determined, and they weren't going to back, you know, let us not try it, and that's how it all got started.
That is the journalist Charlene Hunter Gault. She's with us talking about her experience as one of the first two African-American students to be admitted to the University of Georgia. Also with us hanging on the line, thank you, is Rachel Devlin. She's a historian and author of A Girl Stands at the Door. It's about the generation of young women who desegregated America's schools. And Hank Klibanoff, author of The Race Beat. He now teaches at Emory, but he's a former editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Well, let's integrate all these things here. A WSB TV clip of Governor Ernest Van Devere from January 9th, 1961. This is the day that Charlene and Hamilton Holmes registered for classes at UGA, explaining here that integration is inevitable and that state law prohibits the funding of the integrated university.
It is the saddest day of my life to sign an order recognizing that such a condition as contemplated by the statute does in fact now exist, and that state fund support must be withheld from the university. That I must do when the event takes place. And I am sure that you and the members of the General Assembly understand that no other alternative was available to me.
Charlene, when you heard news like that aligning against you, did you feel like some of the women who Rachel spoke to said they felt like guinea pigs? Did you consider yourself to be a guinea pig?
No. I considered myself preparing to be a journalist, and I think that's what got me through. And listening to the governor there, it is alleged, and Hank might be able to confirm this, that Peter Zach Geer, who was he the lieutenant governor?
Correct.
Yeah, that he actually encouraged the students to riot outside of my dormitory the third night that I had lived on campus. Girls had to live on campus. That was another thing about girls. In those days, Georgia protected its magnolias. They had to live on the boys. And so I was on campus, and there was a riot outside the dormitory. And at one point, they threw a rock through my window. And the police took their time getting there to disperse the crowd, eventually with tear gas. But it is alleged, and again, Hank may know better than I, that there was encouragement for that riot by the higher powers. And of course, we were suspended, quote unquote, for our own safety. Authorine Lucy, some years ago at University of Alabama, had been suspended like that for her own safety. And I think because of the reaction of Thurgood Marshall and Arthurine, which was sort of belligerent, they used that to prevent them from her from coming back. So I had nothing. I didn't say anything. I just walked out into that dark night and got in the car, and they took me to where Hamilton was staying, and they whisked us to Atlanta. But I have to say that years later, Governor Van Devere actually came and apologized for his position.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a very moving moment because he had been the one who said, no, not one. And you heard what he just said a few minutes ago. But things did change over time. Oh, it took a while, but it did.
Hank, you want to pick up on that?
The no, not one echo in history from Governor Van Devere. That had been his mantra when he ran. One interesting backstory that he would later tell, along with the then editor of the Atlanta Constitution, Gene Patterson, was that the night before Governor Van Devere did what he did and said what he said and sort of lifted the ban, in effect, he called Gene Patterson, the editor of the Constitution, said, Gene, what am I going to do? This is just, I'm between a rock and a hard place. What am I going to do? And Patterson, who was very much a progressive on these issues, said, you know what you're going to do, and you're going to do the right thing, and you know that that's the only path to the future, and that resistance will not get you anywhere. And in fact, that's what he did.
Rachel, I want to, before we let you go, you wrote, of course, about the long, protracted legal battles and fights, sometimes lasting years, for the girls and young women who were applying to segregated schools. But once they got there, what was the treatment like? What did they experience?
Well, the girls in the Deep South who a volunteer to desegregate. Some were drafted, the six-year-olds who desegregated in 1960, but most schools started with the 12th grade, and these young women volunteered in vastly disproportionate number. And I have to say that it might sound counterintuitive, but these girls experienced a great deal of violence, usually more violence than the boys. This was because they were small, they were targets, they were vulnerable, and they were kicked, they were tripped, they were spat on, they were prevented from drinking from the water fountain. Sometimes kids threw lit matches in their hair. They could hardly walk down the stairs. It was truly violent. It was a war in these schools. So it's important to remember the sacrifice and the warlike conditions that they endured. It's quite shocking. They survived in the end by fighting back, often in ways that were very creative. But they were received with all the hostility that you might imagine, both from the students and from the teachers.
And many of these firsts, as you found speaking to them decades later, did not go on to do any more school desegregation work. Why not?
Well, right after they graduated, these students were exhausted, and they were in a state of what we might call post-traumatic stress. And many of them, some of them were prevailed upon, for instance, in Louisiana, to then go on and desegregate LSU. None of them made it for the first year. They all transferred to Southern University. Mostly they decided to go to historically black colleges after desegregating a white high school. What's interesting is that later in their lives, they found themselves desegregating professional spaces, faculties, law offices, government offices. And they used the skills that they had learned sort of on the job in high school to desegregate these other spaces as adults.
That's historian Rachel Devlin. Her new book is called A Girl Stands at the Door, The Generation of Young Women Who Desegregated America's Schools. Rachel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We are talking this hour about some of the unsung heroes in the movement to desegregate America's public schools, and among them, reporters for regional black newspapers. Charlene Hunter-Galt is with us. She was one of the first two African-American students to attend the University of Georgia. At UGA, she majored in journalism and, with fellow student activists Julian Bond and Lonnie King, helped to launch the Atlanta Enquirer. That was an African-American newspaper. That was in 1960. Hank Klibanoff is also with us. He's former managing editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In 2007, he wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat, and that's about how the civil rights movement was covered in the national media. Charlene, let's go back to you. When you went to work for the Atlanta Enquirer, you told us a little bit about some of the stories that you were covering, but how did it even get started?
I think it was the brainchild of a very progressive and brave college professor at Clark College, M. Carl Holman, and he was one of the people who had come to Turner High School to see if Hamilton and I would be interested in going to one of the white colleges. And it was his idea. And he recruited Julian, who was an amazing writer and student, and one of the leaders of the Atlanta Committee. It was called the Atlanta Committee on Appeal for Human Rights. And it got started in Carl Holman's basement. And, you know, it started very slowly and there was some support. And we some of the black reporters who worked for the Atlanta Daily World would secretly do reporting for the Enquirer. And one of the funny stories was that there's a great black journalist by the name of Paul Delaney. And he said he needed a pseudonym if he was going to write for the paper because he didn't want to get fired. He had a family and he had to earn the money that he was getting from the Atlanta Daily World. And his name was Paul Delaney. And the pseudonym that was chosen was P. Delano Lane.
You know, there's a similarity in Birmingham. The black newspaper was the Birmingham World, also owned by the same Scott family that owned the Atlanta Daily World. And the editor over there was quite rogue and renegade against the Scott wishes. Emory Jackson from Buena Vista, Georgia, and he too did what Carl Holman did. He recruited Authorine Lucy and Polly Myers from his staff, or Polly Myers from his staff, to desegregate the University of Alabama, and she brought her friend Authorine Lucy along. In the end, for the same reason that Charlene had cited earlier in another case, Polly Myers was not able to go forward to desegregate the University of Alabama because she had gotten pregnant.
Mm.
And so Authorine was given the option to bail out. She said, no, I'm going forward. And in 1956, in what became really an incredibly important decision to desegregate Alabama, in spite of the violence that was coming down, she did so in 1956 after waiting 1,243 days to do that. And the reason it's important is because Dr. King was in Montgomery running the Montgomery bus boycott and couldn't get any news coverage.
Well,
you know, and all of a sudden, Authorine Lucy's about to enroll in Alabama. There's a possibility there'll be bloodshed, and the press just flocks to Tuscaloosa.
Well, so you had these small regional black newspapers, and in some cases, student newspapers, covering what was going on, even in these burgeoning days of the civil rights movement. When did the rest of the mainstream media sort of catch on?
Well, I mean, at the time, keep in mind that television was hardly around at the time, but it was growing. And certainly by 1961, when Charlene's going in, the television coverage is pretty dominant. But if you go back to even 1950, when before 11 years before Charlene got it and Hunter got into Georgia, Horace Ward, who Charlene, of course, came to know very well, Horace Ward tried to get into law school at the University of Georgia. And he couldn't get anywhere. He ended up going to Northwestern, but where he drew support was from the Red and Black, the student newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And to your earlier point, student newspapers across the South were remarkably progressive on this issue. They supported James Meredith at Ole Miss. They supported Authorine Lucy at Alabama. There was student papers at Florida State, Emory, Texas. They were quite progressive on these issues.
Charlene, though, you could not get an assignment from the student newspaper, from what I understand.
No, because as I said earlier, a lot of what was going on in town, like the bowling took place at the white bowling alley in town. And I didn't want to take phys ed, so I insisted on taking bowling. And obviously, they wouldn't let me do that. But I also want to add to what Hank was just saying, Simeon Booker and people like Lerone Bennett, they were black reporters. And Simeon was just honored a couple of years ago by the Polk Awards for Lifetime Achievement. At that point, he was, you know, had a hard time getting around. He was in a wheelchair. But he was one of the groundbreakers. He used to go into the South in some very dangerous situations and actually uncover some of the stuff that was going on that was so heinous to black people. And his work was just pioneering. And
for Jet Magazine. Right.
Yeah, Jet. That's right, for Jet Magazine, and a lot of that was not picked up by the larger newspapers. But there came a time when the point at a lot of attention got paid by the larger newspapers, the predominantly white, the all white newspapers, was during the Freedom Rides. And you know, there was an instance in which a group of whites had thrown bombs into a bus, one of the Freedom buses on which John Lewis was riding. And that made international, those pictures from that incident made international news. And of course, that was a time when, you know, there was communism versus democracy and the Kennedys were trying to, you know, be preeminent in their role as leaders in the country, president and attorney general and so forth. And so that got their attention. And from that point on, there was more attention by the white newspapers to what was going on.
Actually, that was that firebombing of the Freedom Ride bus in 61 was just over in Anniston, Alabama. And two people on the bus were Simeon Booker and Moses Newson, two members of the press. And it certainly got a lot of attention then.
Well, John Lewis has said that the press was sympathetic referees at that time. You know, so this notion of objectivity was maybe maybe that classic notion that you could be the voice from nowhere.
Well, they certainly weren't giving false equivalents, you know, to the righteousness of the civil rights movement and the brutality of the massive resistance.
But now, since then, you know, we've got people like Wesley Lowery covering the Black Lives Movement for The Washington Post, who says, you know, he goes to his white editors and they kind of question him differently. So where are we now in the coverage of race issues?
Well, I've never liked the term objective. My computer is objective, although it tries to think for me sometimes. But I like fairness and balance. I mean, for example, when I first went to South Africa and interviewed Nelson Mandela right after he got out of prison, I mean, the first thing I said to him to distinguish myself from all the other reporters who wanted to talk to him, I started telling him about the civil rights movement and how, you know, I was more or less involved. And how similar segregation in the South was to apartheid in South Africa. I don't consider that crossing the line. And, you know, I think we all bring our experiences to bear on what we cover, even though we try to stick to the four, you know, who, what, when, where, how, and sometimes why. But I think fairness...
I'm going to have to wrap it up here, Charlene. I'm so sorry, but I so appreciate your story, Charlene Hunter-Gault. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Hank Klibanoff, thank you for being with us.
I'm happy to. Thank you.
Let's stay put in Athens, Georgia, with one of its most influential bands, REM. Mike Mills co-founded the group, which broke up in 2011. We asked Mike to add some songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we invite people to choose two songs they think best represent our state. The rules nominate songs written or performed by a Georgian, and you can't nominate your own song. Here is what Mike Mills came up with.
Hi, this is Mike Mills here on Georgia Playlist. My first song of an influential nature is by the Allman Brothers Band. It's called Blue Sky. This song means a lot to me for several reasons, but musically, it's two of the most melodic guitar solos you'll ever hear.
They just keep on flowing.
By the time Wayne Allman and Dickie Betts were doing this, they had worked these solos out. They're not just completely random. They're not completely improvised. I think they probably played them close to this particular way most of the time simply because they're melodically incredible and they're memorable and they sound like something they would have sat down and worked out and played them this way because they sound best this way. At one point, could actually play along to most of both Duane and Dickie's solos on this. Not as well as they play them, but they're so melodic and musical that you can memorize them because they're not just somebody ripping off licks. They're actually playing melodies. And when I realized that, when I realized they weren't just rehashing licks that they knew, that's when I knew there was something special. Listening to Blue Sky really does bring back a lot of the good memories of Macon, Georgia, of which I have a lot. Hanging out with my friends in the first band I was in called Shadowfax, we were all big Allman Brothers fans and we listened to their music all the time. And, you know, Macon had a lot of good things to offer, and this was certainly one of them. Okay, my second song here for Georgia Playlist is, it's called Cool, and it's by Pylon from Athens, Georgia. This is a tremendous song by one of the great underrated bands of all time. When I started listening to Pylon, when I moved to Athens, go to parties and see them play, I was just blown away. Amazing combination of Curtis Crowe's powerful drumming combined with three artists who knew absolutely nothing about music and made the decision to represent their art through music. They had no background at all and they taught themselves this stuff, and it became one of the most amazing collaborations I've ever heard, and this song epitomizes everything that they did. Randy Bewley used to, I don't think he had all six strings on his guitar, and he strung them differently, and he tuned them differently, and he just came up with this amazing thing because he started from a different place than most guitar players, and he just had an amazing ear. The song is, it's kind of spare. There's not that much going on, but there's just enough going on. If you saw Pylon play, and you heard this song, and you didn't dance, it's because you were sick.
That's REM bassist and co-founder Mike Mills. Have a song or artist to nominate for our Georgia playlist? Call us at 404-500-945, your music pick. And for more Georgia playlists, visit gpbnews.org. Before we go today, we want to hear from you. Last week, we talked about the particular mental health challenges facing immigrants. I spoke with Valentina Gonzalez, who left Uruguay and moved to Georgia as a child, and she's now a student at Dartmouth College. Gonzalez is also an undocumented immigrant, but protected from deportation by the Federal Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. She told us that she was sexually assaulted on campus last year.
I think it's hard to, as an immigrant, especially as an undocumented immigrant in the United States, to feel safe in this trauma, and this assault kind of like exacerbated that. When I already don't feel safe walking around campus because I'm scared that someone's going to recognize me and, you know that I'm undocumented and do something to me. And now at night, I'm scared, you know, walking back from the library or to my dorm of, like, being assaulted again.
Valentina Gonzalez's story resonated with several of our listeners. Ann Gerber of Atlanta tweeted, "What a brave young woman. My heart breaks for her trauma. We could all learn from her strength and gratitude." We also got a voicemail from listener Neri Castillo Crawford. She's from Peru, but now lives in the metro Atlanta area.
I just want to share that by the age of 14, not only did I interpret, translate, and went to every parent-teacher conference with my parents to support my younger siblings, but I also balanced checkbooks and refinanced our home and taught my mom how to drive. I don't regret it. I feel like it made me the person that I am today, persevere, teamwork, and always having a great attitude and being thankful for all the blessings that this country has given us.
We want to hear from you. Are you an immigrant living in the U.S.? Have you struggled with mental health issues, not known where to turn? You can leave us a message like Neri did at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, The Raven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.